You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you've ever tossed your used pizza box in the recycling after eating that last piece, you may have been making a recycling faux pas. We'll learn how to recycle the right stuff and learn more about why it's important that we get it right from a reporter who's been following the issue. Now, scientists in a variety of fields have looked into the potential impacts that climate change will have in the future, from agriculture and recreation to weather and disease. A new study from the University of Wisconsin finds that the internet is at risk as well. Researchers looked into what's going to happen to the underground fiber optic cables that bring us the internet as sea levels continue to rise. They found that thousands of miles of those cables could end up underwater and sooner than expected. Paul Barford is a professor of computer science at UW-Madison. He's also the founder and director of the Wisconsin Advanced Internet Laboratory. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What made you want to look into this relationship between climate change and these fiber optic internet cables?
Well, we've been conducting a study here at the University of Wisconsin for the past 7 years on internet infrastructure. And it just so happens that my wife is a climate scientist also at the University of Wisconsin. So it's very natural for me to talk about our study and for her to talk about climate change-related impacts. So this was a study that was just waiting to be done, and we were very pleased with the way that things came together.
Now talk about these fiber optic cables. These are the tubes, if you will, that the internet runs on, and I think most of us are largely unaware of them.
Yeah, the internet is this incredible infrastructure, the largest and most complex infrastructure that's ever been built by humans. And for the most part, it kind of seems like magic. We have it available everywhere. We turn it on and we have access to these amazing services. But when you break it down, and you know, this is what I teach in my classes, how the internet works, at its very basic, basic components require physical connectivity between major cities and from major cities to small towns all over the world. And that connectivity is facilitated by optical fibers that are contained in conduits. And over ground, those conduits are laid 18 to 36 inches below the ground in PVC pipe. And under the oceans, they're laid in quite complex and quite amazing fiber bundles that span the thousands of miles of ocean. But at the end of the day, you know, we have to have these optical fiber cables that that connect us all together.
Now, talk about the cables that you're particularly worried about when it comes to climate change. These cables along the coast that could be in flood zones.
Yeah, so that was the focus of our study. So it's probably not surprising that when a lot of fiber conduit was actually laid during the big boom in the internet in the 1990s, that people weren't really paying too much attention to those early climate change warnings. And as a result, a lot of conduit was laid very close to coastlines. This is because of the efficiencies of right-of-ways and the kinds of permitting that is required to lay this conduit down. So no one was thinking about it when it was originally deployed. And as a result, now, you know, 25 years later or 20 years later, when we have very sophisticated models to predict seawater inundation, it turns out that those fiber runs are actually in danger. And indeed, that's the major outcome of our study, to assess the risk of these conduits with respect to whether or not they'll be either underwater or surrounded by water.
Talking to UW-Madison computer science professor Paul Barford about the risks that climate change and sea level rise pose to the internet's infrastructure, especially in coastal areas. So how much of our internet infrastructure could be affected by what's currently predicted as the level of sea level increase?
Well, that was the main focus of our study, to quantify this risk. And the major results of our study is that thousands of miles of conduit is likely to be underwater. And many of the places where the conduit comes above ground, what we refer to in our study as nodes, these are the places where there are interconnections and where the data that's transferred between our end hosts and the services that provide all of the things that we enjoy are switched. Those are there are thousands of those that are implicated by our study in terms of potentially being surrounded by water. One of the most important aspects of our study is that we actually looked at the places where these submarine cables make land, and you know, it's sort of counterintuitive, but those are actually the places that pose the most risk. So this is the place where the protected cable that can be underwater connects to the unprotected cable that's not supposed to be underwater, and most of those are at risk due to climate change-related sea level rise.
When people hear about climate change, they might think, okay, far off, distant future, plenty of time to deal with the problem. What is your time horizon here?
Well, anybody who lives in a coastal area, I think if you talk to any residents of Miami, you will find out that they are not thinking that way, that it's not way off. And indeed, the surprising finding of our study was that despite the fact that the sea level rise models are all oriented around 100-year projections, we found that all of the implications for the infrastructure that's at risk are indicated in the next 15 years. So the time horizon is very short from a large infrastructure planning perspective, and what we hope is that the major stakeholders, meaning the service providers and municipalities that are implicated, will start looking at these issues very seriously.
So what do we do about this? Do we go back and retrofit millions of miles of cable, or do we replace it or move it? What happens?
Yeah, great question. So our study is a risk study. And what we need to do in our next study, which is what we're conducting right now, is a potential impact study. And after that, then we can begin the planning process. But to sort of skip to the end point, which is what do we do about it, I think that there are three obvious things that can be done. The first is in specific deployments where it's indicated we can harden infrastructure, meaning we can make it more resilient to seawater. I don't think that that's a solution that's viable in the large, but in things like landing points for submarine cable, we might be able to do it. The second is absolutely what you said, which is redeployment. And I think that a lot of redeployment is likely to take place just because what's currently deployed is not meant to be under seawater. And then the third is to actually take advantage of some of the inherent capabilities in the internet to redirect some of the traffic that's currently carried in cables that are above ground and not underwater to inland cables that are maybe less utilized. So those are the three things I think that can be done.
So, Paul, suppose we do nothing. Here in Wisconsin, we might think, okay, this is a coastal problem. We don't need to worry about it. Would we feel the impact?
Well, that is a very important issue. In terms of studying impacts, on one end of the scale, a lot of the impacts are likely to be very localized. So just communities in coastal areas will feel these. However, when you start talking about submarine cables and you start talking about the major trunk lines that follow coastal routes, the ones that we've identified in our study, if those go down, those have implications for the whole internet, not just for coastal areas. So there is definitely a possibility that right here in Wisconsin, if a major underwater cable, transoceanic cable, goes down, we could feel those impacts, and they could be serious.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Paul Barford is a professor of computer science at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about his study finding that within 15 years, thousands of miles of fiber optic internet cables could be underwater thanks to rising sea levels. First, according to the EPA, Americans recycle about 66 million tons of material every year. About a third of that is exported to other countries. In many cases, that's China. But China has gotten stricter about what they'll accept, and recycling has gotten more costly, leaving some states to try different options. Livia Albeck-Ripka is a freelance journalist covering the environment. She's reported on how we as a nation recycle and where our recycling goes for the New York Times. Livia, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've written about problems at both ends of the recycling equation, what we put in and where it goes. And let's start with that first step. You've written, and some people in the recycling trades worry about something they call aspirational or wishful recycling. What is that? What are we getting wrong sometimes?
Yeah, so I think that when the public is putting something into the recycling bin, we all want to do our best. We all hope that what we put in the bin ends up getting turned into something new at the other end. Unfortunately, that's not always the case. And so waste managers actually have a name for this. They call it wishful or aspirational recycling, which is when we're not really sure whether or not something can be recycled or what the particular rules are in our neighborhood, and we just put it in anyway in the kind of hopes that it will eventually be recycled. So some really typical examples of this are pizza boxes. In some areas, pizza boxes are recyclable, so just want to stress that it's really important, whoever's listening, to that you do need to check in your area what can and can't be recycled. But pizza boxes, if they're very, very greasy, waste managers say, you know, these will just actually contaminate the kind of the good recycling materials, and will end up meaning that more stuff goes to the trash. So with a pizza box, you could, you know, tear off the good half, recycle that, throw away the greasy half. If there are just a few crumbs in there, it's not too much of a big deal. And then another really common example of this are disposable coffee cups. And, you know, before I started doing this reporting, I wasn't aware of this either, that many coffee cups are lined with a fine film of polyethylene, which makes them very difficult and expensive to reprocess because you've got two materials there. You've got the paper and it's plastic. And so unless you have a special facility in your area, in your state, that can handle those cups, separate them out and send them to the right place, unfortunately, again, they are kind of contaminating the stream.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, I'll admit, I've been in this situation too, thinking, I'll err on the side of throwing it in, no harm done, yeah. They'll just throw it away anyway. You've talked to some recycling people. I would be wrong to think that way, right?
Yeah, that's right, unfortunately. You know, they stress, if in doubt, throw it out. And it's a hard mental switch to make. And again, as I've been doing this reporting and thinking about recycling in my own life, it is a challenging switch, but recycling and waste managers are talking about this as a real wake-up call. It's a moment for the public to recognize that for a long time we have been sort of, at least we've been kind of putting off the problems of recycling, or we've been kind of imagining that that recycling is going better than it has been. And we've been sending a lot of materials to China in particular, but other countries, and they're saying this is an opportunity for individuals to really think about the role that they are playing when we put something into the recycling bin. And, you know, one of the most profound things that somebody said to me during the reporting was, recycling is the third R. You have to reduce and reuse first. So I think that that's a good thing to think about when you're feeling guilty about, should this really be going in the bin or not? But there are other ways that we can as individuals kind of help with this process.
Now, before we move on to this, from this part of this story, again, it varies from community to community, state to state, what people can and can't recycle. But what were some of the other, in addition to those greasy pizza boxes, those single-use coffee cups, what were some of the other common gripes from people in recycling that shows up that they just don't want?
So a big one is obviously scraps of food or liquid in the takeaway containers, or I guess jars that you might buy from the supermarket with, you know, pasta sauce or whatever it is in it. You know, those don't have to be sparkling clean. And if you were to kind of scrub them, you in turn might be wasting water, but you do need to get out most of the food. So, you know, steer clear of food scraps and liquid scraps. Another one are plastic bags. again, you may have a facility in your area that specifically deals with and recycles plastic bags, but don't put them in with the rest of the recycling because they really tend to clog up the machinery. They can slow things down. Another one, a surprising one, are dirty diapers. These are definitely not recyclable, but they show up often in the waste management stream. So those are some other ones to look out for. And then, of course, this is more to do with you know, safety, but just watching out for batteries or any kind of objects that might cause a fire hazard, because those can actually cause the recycling facilities to have to stop their operations, and that in turn really affects the process.
I know in some Wisconsin communities, they'll take plastic bags if they're bundled up in a plastic bag and mixed with stuff. So that speaks to the check your local listings concept, right?
And I think, again, this is another part of the wake-up call, is how complex the recycling is and how little people tend to know about what can I recycle in my area, what are the rules in my area. The labels can look different between various places. People don't always know where to find the information. But, you know, as a general rule, it's really different in every single municipality in the United States. But as a general rule, if you go to your local municipality website and go to the sort of the waste management area, the recycling area, you will find that information. So it's important to check it out and to learn what the right thing to do where you live is.
Talking about recycling with Livia Albeck-Ripka. She's written about problems at both ends of the recycling story for the New York Times. And Livia, let's go to where the stuff goes. And this is changing. China is changing its policies on what they're going to take right from the United States.
Yes. Yeah, so as you mentioned earlier, Americans recycle around 66 million tons of material a year. And about a third of that is exported. The majority of those exports were going to China, but then in the summer of last year, so about a year ago, China announced plans to ban foreign garbage from its shores as part of a broader anti-pollution campaign. And then since January 1st of this year, it's banned imports of various types of plastic and mixed paper. And so other countries have stepped in and are accepting more waste than they previously were. For example, Indonesia, Vietnam, Mexico. So there has been kind of a little bit of the slack picked up, but the United States has still been left with a lot of excess garbage. Well, I should not call it garbage, actually, and waste managers really stress this. You know, recycling is not trash. It's not garbage. It is material that is potentially valuable and was more valuable. And now it's a matter of working out what to do with that material and perhaps dealing with more of it domestically.
Yeah, the theory, as we put stuff in recycling, Livia, is that it goes somewhere, whether it's in the United States or abroad, and somebody goes through and harvests the materials and has a way to profitably use them in new stuff. Is that really mostly what's happening?
Well, I would say that in the cases where it is getting exported or when it was going to China, in theory, yes, those materials, for example, mixed paper, which, you know, is referred to as fiber, can be turned into new boxes, and that might not have been happening all the time, but it was an economically viable process, and so it's a matter of sort of stepping back and figuring out where to go from here.
And with this change from China now, are local recycling agencies having to change what they'll take with this decline in demand from China?
Yeah, so the West Coast of the United States was the most affected by this ban. They were really heavily reliant on the Chinese market. And so in some cases, in some municipalities along the coast there, and in a few other places around the U.S., waste managers have actually had to change their rules. For example, when it comes to yogurt cups, which is a particular type of, you know, thin plastic that is more challenging to reprocess and to turn into something new, those waste managers said, you know what, for the moment, we can no longer accept that material as recycling. And in that case, those materials which people had previously been putting into the recycling bin, they're asking them, no, now you've got to put them in the trash. And if they don't go into the trash, they're actually then contaminating the other recyclable materials. So it is a challenging switch for people to make and to learn about these new rules in their areas.
The hope, I think, for a lot of municipalities was that their recycling services would be self-sustaining. They're paid for. They turn trash into treasure. Basically, they get paid for the materials, and that helps pay for recycling efforts. Has that panned out that way?
Well, I suppose that what we're seeing now with this ban from China is not really. And again, it's this kind of, it's a wake-up call for what we can do to make the recycling processes better domestically. And when I say domestically, as you can probably tell, I'm not from the US, I'm Australian. And likewise, we have the same problem in Australia and similarly in Europe. A lot of these Western countries were relying on a system that ultimately was not sustainable.
So bringing it back home, Livia, it sounds like it seems paradoxical. If we throw away the stuff that we think we can recycle but we can't, we're actually helping the recycling effort overall. Is that right?
I'm going to need you to repeat that. If
I take that thing that I shouldn't put in the recycling, I throw it away instead, things are going to go more smoothly. Recycling is going to be more successful. Is that right?
Yeah. If you kind of take this, you know, if in doubt, throw it out mentality and just put in what you're absolutely certain can go in there, it is more likely that that the end product will find a market and a destination where in turn it will be actually recycled and turned into something new.
We'll leave it there, Livia. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Livia Albeck-Ripka, freelance journalist covering the environment. She joins to talk about her work in the New York Times on recycling in the United States. Now, a new poll from The Atlantic and the Public Religion Research Institute shows people of color are more likely to have trouble voting than their white counterparts. The difficulties come on a number of fronts, from not being able to get off work to vote to being told that they don't have the right identification. That's just one finding in a big study that finds a lot of divisions in attitudes and perceptions among people across the partisan landscape. Emma Green is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. Emma, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, before, Emma, we dive into some of the particular findings of this study, this is a big study, and a general theme, and you wrote about this, is we seem to be living in two different Americas in a lot of ways. Talk about how that plays out.
So in our study, we asked a range of questions about how Americans see the big problems with our democracy. And what we found is that there are essentially two versions of the country. In one version, the country is headed in the totally wrong direction. Billionaires control politics, foreign governments meddle in elections. Not enough people are standing up and crying out for change. And then in the other America, everything is great. Things are looking up. There's a great president in the Oval Office. And some civic functions are still broken, especially when it comes to media bias and that sort of thing. But in general, things have a much more positive outlook. Those two different Americas don't necessarily talk to one another about basic facts of what's going on in our country. And that makes it really hard to imagine a future when the partisan divisions we're experiencing today are not a characteristic of what we're living in.
Yeah, I think a gut feeling for a lot of people, especially people who observe politics, is that, yeah, we do have this partisan divide. And at least in answers to the questions you all asked, that really does seem to be true.
Absolutely. So there were a few measures that showed that Democrats and Republicans really see things almost in a mirror opposite. So some of them were basic, you know, 91% of Democrats saying that America is on the wrong track, compared of 70% of Republicans who say that the country is going in the right direction. On the flip side, you have things like eligible voters being suppressed from going to the polls. This is something where Democrats really strongly believe that this is a problem, versus voter fraud, where Republicans are much more likely to think that that's the greater issue. So really, on a lot of measures, Democrats and Republicans seem to see the exact opposite reality.
I want to dig into that voter suppression idea. One part of this asked people if they'd been subjected to, if they believe they'd been subjected to various forms of voter suppression or had difficulties voting for one reason or another. And there the big difference wasn't necessarily along partisan lines. It was around racial and ethnic lines. Can you talk about that?
So we saw here that not only are there perception differences about the quality of American democracy, but clearly there are experiential differences as well. People who are white and people who are black or Hispanic seem to have vastly different experiences when it comes to trying to exercise the right to vote. Strong majorities of black and Hispanic respondents to our survey said that the suppression of eligible voters is a major problem in America, and only 27% of white respondents said the same. Now, what's interesting about this to me is that even though that's largely brought on by the proportion of Republican-identified voters who didn't think this is a big issue, less than half of white Democrats, 45%, said that voter suppression is a big issue. So clearly there's a difference between people who are white and people who are of color.
Talking to Emma Green from The Atlantic, talking about a big new survey that The Atlantic co-ran, looking at attitudes toward civic issues and democracy in America. Staying again with voting in America, one of the big issues you talked about. Wisconsin has a voter ID law. The National Commission for Voter Justice hosted a Wisconsin state hearing this last Saturday in Milwaukee. They gave members of the public a chance to express concerns. Here's Linnea Sundstrom sharing her experience as someone working on voter education and voter registration.
First thing I want to talk about is what I call the myth of the free voter ID. So when the lawsuits began gathering, those storm clouds were gathering, the legislature implemented a policy that voters could get a free ID for voting. What they didn't tell you is that you cannot hold that ID and a driver's license at the same time. And this is the number one issue that we see on the streets and talking to people about voting, because a lot of people cannot afford to turn in their out-of-state driver's license to get the free ID, which does not provide driving privileges. So if you have to pay $38 for a driver's license, $40 for an out-of-state birth certificate, et cetera, the free part doesn't apply to driver's licenses. You don't get any help if you need driving privileges.
Emma, it gets a little confusing here in Wisconsin, and your polls showed that people were, in many cases, confused over exactly who could vote, what they needed to vote, how to vote, where to vote.
Absolutely. So one of the big takeaways from our poll is that voters in general don't have a very good grasp on the laws of either their local governments and their states or just generally what's allowed and prohibited in America. But even more than that, our poll showed that people have vastly different experiences. When it comes to voter ID requirements, for example, we found that 9% of black respondents and 9% of Hispanic respondents said that in the last election they were told they lacked the proper identification to vote. This is compared to just 3% of white people. So this suggests that voter ID requirements, confusing laws, other barriers to voting really do have a substantive effect on people's experiences when they're headed towards the ballot box.
And you found similar numbers with people not having, not knowing where to vote, right, or having conveniently located voting locations.
This was really remarkable. 15% of black respondents, 14% of Hispanic respondents said they had trouble finding polling places on election day, and that's compared to just 5% of whites. So this is a real-life stat that underscores academic research that's been done, which suggests that when polling sites are frequently changed and the location is mixed up, that actually has this side effect of hurting minority voter turnout. And for people who are of color who are trying to find a place to vote, the fact that that experiential sort of element really feeds into their perception of our democracy suggests that this is, again, a big difference in how people are experiencing voting depending on their race.
I want to dig in now to another piece of this poll that you reported on. People's perceptions of some of the problems facing civics and democracy. You asked the questions, here's one of them, is the influence of wealthy individuals and corporations a major problem in America's electoral system? And you asked, is media bias against certain political candidates a major problem in America's electoral system? And this is one of those, I think, mirror image responses you talked about in these two questions.
Absolutely. 82% of self-identified Democrats said that the influence of wealthy individuals and corporations is a major problem, and that's compared to just 42% of Republicans. But then you flip that around into this mirror perception. 81% of Republicans said that media bias against certain political candidates is a major problem. That's only 41% of Democrats who said the same. So clearly there are stories that are being told on different sides of the aisle among these different groups about what the major problem is with our democracy, whose fault it is, and how potentially we should try to fix it.
You also saw a disconnect in some cases between stories that the media focuses on a lot and what people on either side of the political spectrum thought were important stories.
Absolutely. And this is something that I hear a lot in my reporting. I cover religion and politics here at The Atlantic, and often when I'm talking with people in conservative communities and especially conservative religious communities, there's a real perception that the mainstream media, which is highly concentrated in New York and Washington and cities like LA and San Francisco, reporters aren't really hooked into some of the major issues and questions that are motivating voters. So I do think that there's a big perception that the mainstream media just hasn't quite synced in and clicked with what the American public is really talking about.
We're talking to Emma Green, staff writer at The Atlantic, about a new survey looking at attitudes toward democracy, toward civics in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this divided political landscape in your country, in your state, in your community, maybe even in your household? Do you feel like sometimes you're speaking a different language when you talk about important issues in the United States with someone from a different political perspective than your own? Do you see room to bring people together, opportunities to get people to sit together at the table and figure out at least what to agree to disagree on? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Emma Green is with us from The Atlantic. We're talking about a new poll from The Atlantic and the Public Religion Research Institute finding Democrats and Republicans have really, really different views on some core issues in American government and democracy. Also found differences by race with people perceiving that they'd been encountered different kinds of obstacles at the polls. Three times as many people of color, for example, had been challenged for the kind of ID they showed at a poll. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Why do you think we have such a strong partisan divide in the United States, as reflected in our politics, our media, and in this survey? Have you ever encountered trouble voting at your local polling station, maybe after you moved or maybe in a place you lived for a long time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, in my experience, and I only can speak for myself, but, to keep our republic, one of the things we do have to do is respect each other. And one of the things I have noticed in my experience is that those on the left assign voters to those on the right. Normally, they are bigoted, they are racist, they're xenophobic, you name it. So they're basically saying, you are evil people. When you look at people on the right who disagree with people on the left, most of their ideas are about, they don't like their ideas. Their ideas are bad, or their ideas they consider inferior, but not them as people. That's a huge divide, and I just wonder, in the polls, if there's anything that the guests saw that kind of outlines why people feel that way on the left versus the right.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there, Emma, and I don't know if the survey got into that level of nuance, but is there an idea that, hey, the other side is less civil than our side, or perception that that's the case?
This wasn't a question that we asked directly, but I will say that in my reporting, I see evidence of this dynamic often. And I think the big issue here is around different conceptualizations of identity. On the left, there are certain notions of identity that often have to do with race and sexuality and certain types of identification, Whereas on the right, it often tends to be slightly more abstract or intellectualized, less of that identification with this notion that who you are should define your politics. I think that ultimately means that the two sides just aren't seeing the same kind of factors when they're looking at each other and trying to understand why somebody of the opposite persuasion would make their decisions.
Steve, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Dave in Chippewa Falls. Dave, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I was just going to express to you the incident that happened to me when I tried to vote in the April election here. I had moved, and I had brought with me to the polls a letter from the Department of Revenue saying that my refund had come through, and a letter from the Department of Motor Vehicles that my registration was due, as well as with my ID from my old address. I was not allowed to vote. I was told, like, that if I had a concealed carry permit, that I then could vote. So I had to go to work, come home, and get my lease, and bring that back to the polls again late that night in order to vote. I mean, it's kind of crazy when there's two state agencies that recognize my home address, but they won't accept that, but they will accept the concealed carry permit.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. And Emma, digging more into what the survey said about people being challenged at the polls over their eligibility to vote, talk a little more about that.
So we found this was a particularly strong factor when it came to racial divisions. 10% of black respondents and 11% of Hispanic respondents said that they had been incorrectly told that they weren't listed on voter rolls. And this had happened to roughly 5% of white respondents. So this suggests that, first of all, automatic voter purges have a huge effect on voters, and particularly they have some evidence of strong racial and ethnic bias. And the second factor here is it's one greater sign that confusion among voters and big bureaucratic changes, all of these different rules that govern our voting process, mean that there are fewer people who are able to actually cast a ballot, and some people wouldn't have that determination to go back at night and try to really prove that they're eligible to vote.
Yeah, and in Dave's case, this is maybe in that confusion point, whether it was Dave or the poll workers, people at some point in the process not being clear on how you establish your right to vote in a new address.
Absolutely. I think that sense of confusion and just even crosstalk among the different municipal organizations, as he was indicating, really can create a barrier for people. And that barrier only gets higher for people who have less of an education, less of an understanding of their rights, perhaps don't have time to take off from work to be able to go to a polling place twice in one day. Those just mount and mount and mount.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dave. We'll go now to Jamie in Wisconsin Rapids. Jamie, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to bring up, Jamie?
Well, listening to your program, I don't know a lot about it, but I live in a town where there's not a great deal of diversity with different people and people of color, but I think it's so unfair, and I'm wondering why do we have the right to challenge other people? And that kind of bothers me because people of color have the right to vote. And why are they challenged so much like that?
Jamie, thanks a lot for that call. And Emma, the answer to that probably varies from state to state and community to community. But do you have thoughts on how we vote and why people of color are more likely to have these kind of experiences?
This is a big question, and I think the simplest answer is history. We look back to the history of the United States and see that over time, time and time again, legislators have created roadblocks to people voting, and this has disproportionately been targeted at black people and people of color. In particular, in recent years, we've seen rules that target recent immigrants, people who might be of Hispanic origin, and this connects with the long history from the Jim Crow era of discrimination against black voters. So it's not that today's voter rules are necessarily racist explicitly or would say in their text that they're trying to eliminate black voters or Hispanic voters, but what they do often do is structurally create these side effects that mean that black and Hispanic voters are feeling more of the burden of this kind of discriminatory law. And whether or not that was intended by the legislators, it still has the same effect.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Emma Green from The Atlantic, talking about a new big survey looking at American attitudes toward democracy, civic issues, and voting. Emma, you report on religion, and you found some religious differences among people by denomination. What kind of things did you see people of different religious faiths differing on?
Well, we've certainly seen across reporting and across this survey that there are big perception differences among, for example, self-identified white evangelical Christians, and in contrast, people who are religiously unaffiliated. Even within white Christians, depending on whether you're Catholic or evangelical or mainline Protestant, there are pretty big perception differences about the state of our politics. One statistic in particular stood out to me, which is that 94% of self-identified white evangelical Protestants said that media bias is a major or minor problem in America's current electoral system, which basically means everyone in America who is a white evangelical Protestant believes that there's some sort of media bias. This is a really interesting fact, in part because white evangelical Protestants are so much a part of our conversation today about what's happening in the political sphere. So I was really struck by that, and I've really tried to take that to account in my reporting.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bill is on the line in Eau Claire. Bill, hi.
Hi, my name is Bill, and I work with a group here in Eau Claire called Chippewa Valley Vote. And we work closely with voters one-to-one to get them registered to vote. We've registered more than 400 voters this year. And we've worked with a lot of folks who hit barriers along that process, whether it's students who move frequently or homeless voters. And we're trying to launch an idea in Wisconsin to embrace automatic voter registration for a lot of the reasons that your guest has shared regarding voter suppression. And so we're asking candidates running for state assembly and state senate to endorse that idea, hoping that once they get to the legislature, we can see that happen in Wisconsin. 12 or 13 other states around the country have automatic voter registration so that when someone does go to the DMV to renew their license or to the DNR to buy a fishing license, their voter registration files with the Elections Commission are automatically updated.
And Bill, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. Emma, I don't have the page in front of me, but I think you asked people about their attitudes toward that sort of automatic voter registration.
Yeah, and one fact that really underscores what the caller is saying is that 1 in 10 blacks and Hispanics reported missing the registration deadline to vote in 2016 compared to just 3% of whites. So that sort of shows the opposite effect, which is that registration deadlines and really big barriers to getting registered really result in tangible reductions in who is voting and how many people can vote. So that's just sort of another fact to throw in there in this policy debate about whether automatic registration might be good for the state.
We'll leave it there for now. Emma, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Emma Green, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. She joined us to talk about a new poll by The Atlantic and the Public Religion Research Institute looking at attitudes toward a variety of issues, voting, democracy, civic engagement, and more in the United States.